Committee on Water is hereby convened for January 30, 2003. Welcome to all of you this morning. Looking forward to hearing your presentations and having interaction with you. Before we get started, my standard plea to you all is to make you aware of, again, the ORSs that have been on the books for many years in regards to truthful and accurate testimony. We expect and believe that all of you will certainly comply with that. It applies only to professional lobbyists and government officials. It does not apply under statute to members of the general public. And so, having said that, again, we welcome you. We look forward to hearing from you. And the chair would like to continue with, and actually before I do that, members, to let you know that this meeting and our next meeting will be, again, focusing on the Oregon plan and really getting the entire overview of it. We will be on Thursday of next week, a week from today, attending again a field trip, I guess, for lack of a better term, to someplace close by where we can observe some of the issues that are ongoing that are very closely related to the Oregon plan. So, again, put that on your calendar. We may be a bit late to floor session for that particular day, so we're hoping to work that out, and we will talk to leadership about that. We don't anticipate that we'll need to be excused at this point, but we'll for sure keep you posted. Yes, Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I assume that staff will take care of it. We'll make sure that we're going to be excused from
fourth
session. Thank you.
Again, it isn't our intention to do that, but we may choose that as a course of action if necessary. And please be remembered to perhaps wear rain gear and rubber boots if this weather continues, and we'll be down in the water anyway. So it'll be a great opportunity to see what Oregon's doing in hard terms, in terms of actually what projects are on the ground that relate to the Oregon plan. And with that, the chair would like to call Kelly Moore from OWEB, if you'd come forward, please. Bruce McIntosh. And Rich, how do I say your last name, Rich?
Hafley,
okay. It's Rick?
Yes.
It's spelled Rick here, or Rich, actually. I'll make that change. And for the record, when each one of you address us initially, please state your name. Thank you. Welcome, Kelly. Glad to have you here.
Yes, Representative Cup, members of the committee, my name is Kelly Moore. I work for the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board as a monitoring policy advisor. And we're here to talk to you today about monitoring under the Oregon Plan, the roles of state agencies in particular. That's why today I have with me Dr. Bruce McIntosh from the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and Rick Hafley from the Department of Environmental Quality. I will give a little overview of some of the things we're doing with monitoring, and each of these gentlemen will then have a chance to talk about some of the information that's being collected and how we're using it. Last Tuesday, Lindsey Ball from ODFW was here, and he told you some good news. He told you that the returns of coho salmon to the coast were at record high levels. And you know you can believe that because Lindsey Ball, first of all, tells the truth. And you could also believe it because he's got the information. And the reason he's got the information to back that up is because of the monitoring his department has put in place under the Oregon Plan. We not only know that it's a record return, we know the number. It's going to be around 260,000 coho spawning in coastal streams this winter. And we know where they're distributed, and we can answer questions that are involved in that. It's something that other states can't do. If you ask Washington State, they'll tell you they have a number of index streams and things are looking good. If you ask California, well, first, we don't know who to ask in California sometimes what the conditions are. So Oregon has made investments in monitoring that have prepared us to deal with the issues before the committee and before the legislature and before the agencies this year. And this means that particularly in the sense of defining recovery for salmonids, we have the kind of information that can be used to address ESA requirements, meet the expectations of various science committees that if we do our work, the work will also fit with the work of the Salmon Recovery Task Force to provide the kind of information that's needed. And this means it doesn't not just salmon abundance, but how they're distributed, how they're using the habitat, the condition of the habitat, including water quality. And we are measuring those things, and we report on them with some scientific certainty. And finally, we are looking very closely at the activities conducted in the Oregon Plan by landowners, by watershed councils and soil and water conservation districts and others to improve conditions and evaluate our progress in those areas. It's part of what we're doing. I'm going to ask the committee if you still have your copy of this document, the final report for the Oregon Plan. If you do not, we have extra copies. And once
did we stockpile them over here?
Yeah, we
very good. Why don't you pass them out? Kelly, appreciate you bringing extra copies. However, that would give us three copies each.
Our goal at OEB is to make sure that your copy becomes well dog-eared before this series of hearings is over. And in this, if you have it on pages, starting on page 46, there's four pages that describe the overview of the monitoring program. Some of the important points to remember are that these investments in monitoring for the Oregon Plan began in 1996 and 97 with the action of the legislature to fund increased levels of monitoring in coastal basins. But in the data that you see on all the other pages that document the work that's been done is part of the monitoring program. A person who works with us at OEB administers a database that allows us to report this information on private land and the property work that's done. There's a lot of effort out there. There's a green folder or green little binder on your desk. And in there are some other documents that we use in the monitoring program. The first one is this one, Oregon Plan Monitoring Strategy. This is a result of work that's been going on with the monitoring team the last several years to really document our approach, to focus the kinds of questions we ask with respect to monitoring, and to make some statements about how we organize our work. Now, that's a lot of reading, and I kind of was wondering if this didn't put you to sleep, pick this one up and read it tonight, and I think that'll do the trick and you'll be okay. But it is important that we're organized around a strategy. Key elements of the strategy are on page 49 in this in the final report. And it basically says we're going to work on assessments that tell us the status of our watersheds, document the work we do. We're going to spend a lot of time evaluating the work we do to see how well it's affecting improvements in fish runs and watershed health. And we're going to spend considerable effort to coordinate our efforts so that there's not redundancy of efforts, so that there's not different agencies showing up to do the same thing at the same time, that kind of work. And there's a tremendous amount of work going on. There's another little document in your packet that just lists those activities by state agencies and watershed organizations and others who are contributing to the Oregon Plan directly, and that's statewide. It's on the map, this one. You don't want to go into that, but very briefly, there's maybe 100 of activities, things that OEB has funded and things that have been funded through the other agencies and people we cooperate with to support monitoring the Oregon Plan. A lot of that are assessments of watersheds being done locally so people can plan their activities. There are many, many other activities going on around the state. The Oregon Plan, OEB, we don't direct those activities, but we do try to make sure they are coordinated, and that's the function of the monitoring team that both Bruce and Rick are members of. Those are some of the key things I think you should know. There's a list of the monitoring team members in that packet. I chair a meeting that's held once a month where we work on coordination issues. There's a couple of copies of agendas in your packet as well that gives you kind of a feel for the kind of work we do. Last fall, we held a workshop in Corvallis that was put on by the monitoring team, and we invited about 120, actually we invited about 80 scientists and policymakers from around the region. 120 showed up, and we had 2 days of discussions about where the priorities should be for monitoring and how the data we have been collecting is being used both for at policy levels to make decisions about fishery management and water quality issues, and locally for people to plan their own work so that the investments they make in watershed health are directed and focused to those areas where the work needs to be done. With that, I think I'll stop there and let Bruce continue with some of the work that ODFW does and describe progress they're making.
Excuse me, Representative Dingfelter has a question or comment.
I have a question for Kelly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you talk a little bit about the protocol that you're using for monitoring? Because one of the things that, and I know you've worked on this, Kelly, and I just want to get an update on status, with all these different agencies, state, federal, local agencies are doing monitoring. Can you explain for the committee what you've done to make sure that the assessment tool that's being used is consistent?
Yeah. Well, it's at different levels, but at the base level of what people do when they're on the ground, the monitoring team and OWEB have worked to standardize protocols for water quality monitoring, for ways of collecting and aquatic invertebrate information, other water chemistry parameters, and the way we do measure stream habitat. Those have been published and distributed to larger councils. When a council or SWCD comes to OWEB with a grant application for monitoring, if they cite that and say they're going to use those methods, then that helps. At an intermediate level, there's a review of monitoring proposals that come to OWEB by the monitoring team to make, it's primarily a kind of a science checkoff. We don't deal with policy issues of those proposals or the local conditions that are going on and why they came forward. That's the job of the regional review team, so we do a kind of evaluation of their scientific merits and make suggestions. At the agency level and statewide, we have a sampling protocol that allows us to be more efficient. This is what both Bruce and Rick may talk about, and that is we have selecting sample sites that represents the environment, and so we can save some certainty about fish numbers, habitat, water quality. The way this works, I think Representative Cruz and others may remember in the mid-90s we did extensive stream surveys around the state, and in the Umpqua Basin in particular, I think we surveyed over 1,000 miles of stream as in a cooperative effort. That gave excellent baseline information that could be used to plan their work. Under the current sampling program, we've got the coast covered and some areas of the Willamette Valley covered. In the Umpqua, though, to update that information and document the status and trends, we're going to about 25 or 30 sites per year, about 15 miles per year. So instead of having to survey 1,000 miles, we can characterize the basin with that kind of sampling effort. So by applying a sampling approach, we think we are being more efficient and standardizing what's going on in the field.
Thank you.
Kelly, I have a couple of questions for you before we move on to your two colleagues there. You are completely relying upon the watersheds to do the monitoring, or do you have staff that actually goes out and accomplishes some of the monitoring itself?
At OWEB, we do not go out in the field and do monitoring. In the other agencies, and not just ODFW or DEQ, but if forestry and agriculture, they have their own staff, and they work with federal agencies. So the people you see on this monitoring team are those people in these agencies and organizations that have monitoring responsibilities for that organization.
Okay, very good. Next question is, are you, and you've just articulated in your earlier comments about the protocols that have been established, and when a watershed comes and makes application for a grant to accomplish monitoring, part of that decision-making process, it sounds like, is their agreement to follow your established protocols. Is that correct?
It's going to be looked on much more favorably when a grant application comes in with all those protocols. It really, there's always room for innovation or other approaches, but it's part of that process.
Okay. Now, the question I'm driving at here is, are you confident that the information you get from the watersheds, based on the monitoring techniques that you've developed and the protocols that you've established, and your experiences with auditing those, looking at them, evaluating them, are you confident that that information is accurate?
For the most part, it's not just confidence, it's because we evaluate information and grade it in some cases if that works. Maybe Rick could talk a little bit about DEQ. They support volunteer monitoring for water quality and have a system where our samples are actually split and some go to the DEQ lab and some are analyzed locally to deal with that. In ODFW, there are a number of spawning surveys and habitat surveys and other kinds of work that follow the same basic protocol that ODFW staff uses with their own people, and that information is used. There's variability in the data that comes in from larger councils and small water conservation districts, but we have worked to try to give people the information they need to match our standards.
And last question before I turn to my colleagues here of questions for you is, the reason I'm asking this question is because we are establishing the baselines for streams. This will be used for future decision-making processes. how long will you, are you intending to establish a baseline over a period of years in a stream, a particular body of water, or do you just do it one, do you do the monitoring at one particular moment, and that's your baseline from then forward, or are you going to take an average of monitoring over a period of years? What is the intention there?
Again, Representative, members of the committee, that varies with the project. Watershed assessments that watershed councils and SWCDs do gather existing information and attempt to establish that baseline. Where there's gaps in the information, they request funds to do new work to, again, establish that baseline. The overall, and it is in the strategy to some extent, but there's this idea that we do some work up front to establish these baselines, and then we can reduce the effort at some point to just track how things are going. It's different for counting fish than it is for doing water quality. It takes into account historic patterns when they're available. We ask councils and others to look at the sort of try to reconstruct what the conditions were like earlier so that they have something related to. But for the most part, we're looking at baselines that have been established over the last 7 or 8 years under the Oregon Plan and looking for progress on those where it's appropriate.
Okay, thank you. Representative Cruz and then Representative Schaffler.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions. Number one would be, are the federal agencies, BLM, Forest Service, willing to modify their protocols to match yours, or do you just have to match data sets after the fact?
Representative Cruz, member of committees, it varies with between the BLM and the Forest Service. The BLM actually contracts with ODFW to do the stream surveys they need to work through their management. So in that case, it's the same exact protocol, the same way of using the data.
Okay.
The Forest Service has spent a considerable time and effort since implementation of the Northwest Forest Plan to develop their own protocols for monitoring streams, and they've taken a slightly different approach, but at the base level, when we're talking about how you measure a pool, what is large wood in a stream, how do you dimension that material, we work together to make sure that our information can be matched up at that level, even though the analysis and the way we collect the data is a little different.
Okay, I know that they have federal regs that they've got to meet, and sometimes they can't marry up. The other thing, what I would like to see would be the narrative, for example, of your protocol on stream temperature.
Representative Cruz, we can provide that to the committee. We have that at many copies that open.
Okay, thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you. Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. Mine's a real layman question, because I am a layman. But I drink water, and I love to fish, and I eat food that people grow with the water we use. Let's assume that your data is accurate. And I know that may be a big assumption. Assume it is. Would you say, based on what you have, that the record returns you mentioned at the beginning are they due to our efforts for protecting habitat, restoring habitat, all that stuff, or are they due to the ocean conditions, or both, or neither, or do you know?
We think we know, but the order of the importance can be debated. But it's clear right now that ocean conditions are providing this boost that we're seeing these coastal populations. Ocean conditions combined with the management of selective fisheries by ODFW that has reduced harvest. We actually can evaluate now the survival rate of the wild fish in the ocean because of the monitoring ODFW does. It's been in the neighborhood of 8 to 10% the last 2 years. During the period where we were having so much trouble, ocean survival was less than 1% for the smolts that went to the ocean. But the key here is what is our habitat providing? That is the smolts that go to the ocean. If we can get better freshwater survival so that more smolts go to the ocean, we will see bigger returns and continued growth in these runs. And our measurements in habitat show that that's occurring in many places where we do the habitat work. We can't really quantify how many more fish did we get as a result of our habitat work, but we can quantify how many more stream miles have been opened up because of fish passage, and we can quantify survival rates in some of our more intensively monitored areas to show that the efforts to increase stream complexity and other actions are working. So overall, It's the ocean. If we didn't have a good ocean, we wouldn't be enjoying these runs. But everything else we do, including fish management, contributes to what we're seeing right now.
Thank you.
And Kelly, one last question from me. Do you believe that some of our management activities directly related to the Oregon plan and the monitoring and all of this scenario that we've put together as a state is responsible for some salmon actually choosing now to propagate in areas where they previously have not been recorded as having done so?
Absolutely. I'm stepping on Bruce's points here, but the fact is, through our monitoring, we knew 7 or 8 years ago, we went to these random sites. We went to about 400 sites up and down the coast, and we found fish in about 25% of those, Coho salmon about 25%. This last year, a different sample set, it's randomized, it's a sophisticated design, but out of the 450 or 500 sites we went to, we found Coho salmon in over 90% of the sites. That documents the use of the habitat and expansion of these populations in ways that is very important for those recovery processes and the decisions about recovery I was talking about earlier.
Very good. Thank you. You're next.
Chair Krupp, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bruce McIntosh, and I am the Acting Assistant Conservation and Recovery Program Manager for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. I hope you're enjoying that wonderful fish weather we're seeing outside. Hopefully we can have some more to benefit all of us.
It needs to be colder.
Roy Elker and I were just talking about that in the hall.
We can pray.
Kelly has touched on some of the points that I'd like to make, but I am going to talk about ODFW's role in the monitoring program specifically. As Director Ball talked to you about on Tuesday, as part of the department's statutory responsibility to manage the state's fish and wildlife resources, we take the lead in monitoring and evaluating the biological status of species and their habitats. In the fish world, our focus is on salmonids and other listed species at this point. With the utility of the information helping us assess our progress towards recovery and ultimately delisting. A second component of that is that we, with others in the region, are responsible for defining success in terms of the biological status of species and their habitats. In other words, setting the bar for restoration and recovery. We'll accomplish that through working on developing conservation plans under the Native Fish Conservation Policy and then through the federal ESA processes. Clearly, there is a melding of those going on at this point. In terms of monitoring, ODFW is not new to this. As Kelly alluded to, for many of the species of concerns, we have records that go back upwards of 50 years, and we've used those to keep track of populations like coho, steelhead in places on the east side, etc. But as the Oregon plan was being developed, it became clear that we lacked the type of information, the range of information, to be able to understand how sustainable these populations could be over time. So with new funding that came with the Oregon plan, ODFW expanded their coastal monitoring program from simply looking at adult salmon to looking at juvenile salmonids, life cycle monitoring, and habitat monitoring. This program was developed with the monitoring team that Kelly's talked about in cooperation with NOAA Fisheries. It's a very intricate design, and I won't bore you with the details, but the reality is that it now provides us with the type of information that will be essential to establishing recovery goals and ultimately measuring recovery. The Oregon Department of Environmental Quality and OWEB and the other state agencies have played major roles in the development of the Oregon Plan monitoring strategy. It's clear over the last 6 or 7 years, if you go around the region, you talk to the state science advisors, the Power Planning Council science advisors, and even NOAA Fisheries science advisors, that what we're doing here in Oregon is recognized as the model across the West Coast. Whether it's talking about monitoring fish or monitoring water quality, we're setting the standard. In terms of what we've learned from the new monitoring, for the first time now, the state has comprehensive data on juvenile coho and steelhead abundance, habitat conditions, and freshwater and marine survival for coastal watersheds, in addition to the ongoing adult monitoring. What ODFW's analysis shows is that the abundance of coho salmon has increased sharply since 1998. If you look at figure one on my testimony, you can see the data from 1990 to the present on our adult monitoring across the coast. And what you see in the 90s was populations ranged between 30 to 80,000 returning adults. And in year 2001, we saw that increase to about 160,000, then about 260,000 in this past year. The numbers we saw this past year are the highest we've seen since 1952. This response is largely due to the favorable ocean conditions we've seen in recent years. Figure 2 documents the marine survival of coastal coho. And what, as Kelly said before, we saw very low survival rates in the late 90s, in the 1 to 4% range, and upwards of a doubling in the last 2 years. So clearly, fish are going to the ocean in good shape and experiencing those favorable conditions. In addition, ODFW was instrumental in developing what's known as Amendment 13 in the Pacific Fisheries Management Commission realm, which is a harvest management strategy that's designed to protect wild fish while allowing commercial and sport harvests of abundant hatchery fish. Favorable ocean conditions are the result of strong spring upwelling that results in increased survival for smolts as they go to the sea. In addition, our habitat data now tells us what types of habitat conditions are lacking for salmon and steelhead and provides the management direction towards addressing these deficiencies. This information is used, will be used whether it's in conservation planning or through watershed councils across a whole range of interests. And it's clear through the recovery processes, this type of detailed information is again going to be essential to the work we do in the future. So where to from here? I think based on the results of the last 6 and 7 years, ODFW is working aggressively with our partners, whether it's state natural resource agencies, OWEB, PGE, or the tribes, to expand this program to other parts of the state. With OWEB support, ODFW is implementing the first comprehensive adult steelhead survey across the coast as we speak. And in 2003, we're expanding the coastal program to the lower Columbia. These two efforts will be critical to Oregon's ability to evaluate our Lower Columbia Coho Recovery Plan and other ESA processes. In addition, ODFW has received approval through the Power Planning Council process to implement the program in what's known as the Mid-Columbia region. This would be the watersheds Deschutes through the Walla Walla. We are currently in the process of negotiating a contract with BPA on this. I think in summary, the continuation expansion of the Oregon Plan monitoring programs will maintain Oregon's leadership in monitoring and evaluation of the status of species in their habitats and assessing the progress towards recovery and delisting. While the early results are promising, it's clear the state must maintain long-term monitoring to assess whether recovering populations are ultimately sustainable under variable environmental conditions. In closing, I want the committee to understand that this has really been a cooperative effort among agencies, both state, federal, local interests, and we owe our thanks to a large cadre of dedicated professionals, and ultimately we owe our success to the cooperation of private landowners. Our sampling program, I'm sure to folks in the coast, feels like a small troop is walking around their watersheds, but with all the sites Kelly talked about, we have about a 5% denial rate in terms of access to these sites. So it has been, we have this information because private landowners are cooperating with us. With that, I'll close and take any questions.
Are there any questions for Bruce? No, thank you, Bruce. Next, we're going to hear from Rick Haefeli from Department of Environmental Quality. Thanks, Rick.
Representative Dingfelder, members of the committee. My name is Rick Haefeli. I work for the Department of Environmental Quality, and I'm the manager of the biomonitoring section for the department. We've been quite involved with the Oregon Plan monitoring effort since its inception. We were involved in the actual design of the monitoring plan as it was being developed. Kelly and Bruce have already covered a lot of the information relative to the Oregon Plan monitoring, I want to touch on a few things that I think are important and some that relate to DEQ. First of all, I think it's important to mention that to be successful, monitoring efforts that we're involved in really need to have some long-term consistency. The kind of value of the data becomes more valuable over time. And as we said, as Kelly mentioned, we're laying down the baseline information now. And over as the years progress, the value of that will become much more obvious and important, I think. The other key aspects are to have clear questions. Any monitoring program has to be based on some clear questions. And on the handout you have that I provided in information this morning, summarizes some of these, and these are outlined in more detail in the monitoring strategy that Kelly referred to. And part of the questions also refers to the geographic scale that we're trying to get answers to. It's sometimes quite challenging to collect information that applies on a statewide level, applies at a regional level, and also at a watershed level. And obviously there's important questions that people have at all those different scales. So, for example, at DEQ, we're monitoring and have for 20, 30 years a statewide ambient river water quality network that's sampled on large streams around the state. And this has been an ongoing set of data that has become our primary tool, really, for understanding some of the water quality changes that occurs from year to year around the state. So that's a very valuable statewide network that we've had ongoing. At a watershed level, we are involved primarily at the with TMDLs, working through those problems at a watershed scale with a lot of input and interaction with watershed councils. So that's an activity that I think applies really well at that scale. At a regional scale, such as the Oregon Coast Range or Willamette Valley, is where I think the Oregon Plan and the cooperation we've had with other agencies is really providing the kind of data that will become useful at that scale. The key parameters that DEQ is involved in sampling as part of the Oregon Plan includes water chemistry, stream habitat information in cooperation with ODFW, aquatic life information on aquatic macroinvertebrates, for example, fish and amphibians, to get some other information on biological health and condition in the streams so we can get earlier indicators, perhaps, how things are going that might relate to the recovery of fish and their status. I think the other thing to point out is that monitoring work requires a lot of detailed activities. It's a lot more than someone going to a stream and grabbing a water sample. There's a lot of people involved in just equipment development, equipment maintenance, the field sampling, the logistics involved, contacting landowners to get permission is also part of that. It's often remote areas, a lot of intensive work to do the sampling. And then when the samples come back, we have chemists that have to analyze the samples, a lot of data management. The whole idea about the accuracy of the data was brought up earlier, and it's a very good question. We have QA personnel that are directly involved in assessing the accuracy of the data as it's through each step of this process. And we do have a volunteer monitoring position at DEQ that works with the watershed councils. It helps them actually develop their monitoring plans so they're not getting off on the wrong track from the beginning. And we also review their data and assess the quality of that data when they are finished with it, if they'd like us to look at it. So we try to work with the watershed councils on the data quality issues. And then, of course, there's data analysis and reporting that has to be done at the end to make sure that the data actually becomes useful. So there's different personnel and needs all along that whole series of steps that make the monitoring program successful. I think with that, I can conclude my comments and be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Rick. Are there any questions? Representative Schaffler?
I have one, and it's kind of to all of you guys. When these landowners generously allow us on our state on their land to monitor these things, are we following up with them and, first of all, thanking them? And are you sharing with them what you're doing and the results and what the benefits of this? Are you really doing a good job of doing that? Because just getting permission, walking on their land, and then saying, seeing you later, I mean, I really want to share all that information with them. Are we doing that? I mean, do they get one of all this stuff too? And if they don't, I think they should.
Representative Schaffler, we do share information with them from the data we've collected on their property. Mm-hmm. There is typically a lag, a period, sometimes 9-10 months, because we have to get that data processed, right, analyzed, and whatnot. But we do send a letter back to the landowners with the results that we've collected from their property. And that's from the data that we're collecting, and so there would be other people involved in contacting them as well. But we definitely try to get that back to them.
Thank you. Chair Dingfelder, Representative Schaffler. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife follows up with the same type of approach. When we contact landowners, we do have background information on what the overall program's about and the types of things we're doing and where the information goes and what it's used for, and follow up with those that want the information, et cetera. So there's a lot of good public relations that go on in that realm.
Thank you.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, I think that is good news, but there's a lot more work to be done in that area. If you look at the challenges ahead for the monitoring that's in this document, there's a section that says turning data into information. We make these landowner contacts, and we try to stay in touch and let them know how things went so they have the information they need. But too often, well, it's not too often, it's just part of the process that the data often gets reported in these thick documents loaded with tables like this, that are not intelligible to most landowners or many scientists or agency managers or legislators. So there's a real need to take that information and make sure that it's integrated across these agencies to tell the story, and so that it can be understandable at different levels. And actually at OWEB, we have two positions in data management that were given to us, or we obtained last session, that focus on that issue, and there's a lot more work to be done.
Thank you. Any other questions for the panel? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
I'm going to call up Dr. Piercy from the Independent Multidisciplinary Science Team. And I will, just a reminder for folks, if you could refrain from using acronyms, because not everybody is familiar, although I like to say IMST because the long version is very difficult. If you could just remember to at least state it in the beginning so folks up here can follow along with you. And could please state your name for the record.
I'll refer to the team, which is the
there you go.
IMST.
Thank you.
But it is the Independent Multidisciplinary Science Team. So maybe that's the last time I'll say it. I don't know. But as you know, it was established by Senate Bill 924.
Excuse me, can you just state your name for the record, please?
I'm sorry. My name is Bill Piercy. I am co-chair for the IMST along with Stan Gregory. Stan gives his regrets. He was supposed to be here today, but he's teaching a class right now and can't make it. And to be frank with you, Stan is much more eloquent than I am, so you have to bear with me. And actually what I was going to do is use this as a guideline, because a lot of information on the IMST is in here, and I would probably refer to this, and if you want to refer to it as well, it's fine.
And that's page 50 for folks
page
who are looking
50, right.
in your book.
Anyhow, we were established under Senate Bill 924 and signed into law by the governor in 1997. And the main role of the IMST is to provide evaluation and guidance for the Oregon Plan. And this particularly refers to, of course, salmon recovery and watershed health, watershed restoration and health. So those are the general missions of the IMST. And as it says in this document that you have, we provide the public, the governor, and the Oregon legislature with a frame of reference when struggling with policy decisions affecting Oregon Plan implementation. And I would stress that the IMST is not involved in policy. We're involved with science. We make these guidances and recommendations, and it's up to agencies and the state actually to implement those in policy. So we're not a policy organization. Some of our recommendations certainly have implications towards policy. So the IMST, the team, is appointed, as you probably know, by the governor with the approval of the House Speaker and the Senate President. So it takes three people to actually nominate and approve, appoint people for the team. And at the present time, as you can see here, the members are John Buckhouse, who is in range management at OSU, Wayne Elmore, who is with the Bureau of Land Management in Prineville, Stan Gregory, who is in Fisheries and Wildlife at OSU, Kathleen Cavanaugh, who is in Forest Resources Department, University of Idaho. She used to be in Oregon. and she's now in Idaho. Me, Bill Piercy, with the Oregon, with the College of Oceanic and Atmospheric Sciences. Carl Schreck, who is with USGS and also the Department of Fisheries and Wildlife at Oregon State University. And the seventh position is vacant, and it's been vacant for about a year. So those are the team members. And what I'd like to do next is just go over some of the activities and products that the IMST, our team, has been involved with over the past several years. First of all, activities, we have monthly meetings, usually in Corvallis, Oregon. And these meetings are open to the public. And in addition to those, we have various subcommittee meetings, usually during the month as well. Some of our meetings have been held in Eastern Oregon. We had one meeting in Prineville, another meeting in La Grande. So they're not all in Corvallis, but most of them are. We've also been requested to have briefings. Most of these briefings are with the SR2 committee, for example, Governor's Natural Resources Office, Oregon Water Resources Commission, the Joint Interim Task Force on Recovery, and the core team have all sort of asked us to give them briefings at certain times. We have the main products of the IMST are written reports. And these written reports are usually either what we call technical reports, which are very comprehensive, or letter reports. And the way it works is that the IMST meets at our monthly meetings, and we have these subcommittees, and we'll select a topic that we think is important for the success of the Oregon Plan. And we have extensive literature review of the scientific and technical literature that's based, that is relevant to these subjects. We have interviews and input briefings, you might say, by state agencies that come to our meetings and by technical experts on these subjects. After we have this, we have a draft report which is written. And if it's approved by the IMST, then it's sent out to technical experts around the country for scientific peer review. And that's not all. This is a lengthy process. After we get those reviews back and we get a final document that's adopted by the IMST, we send the document out to state agencies for their comment. So it's a long process. Some of these reports take a year, for example, to complete. Then we make recommendations in these reports, generally to state agencies. And by law, the state agencies have 6 months to respond. And they give us their comments back on what they think our recommendations are, how valid they are, whether they're applicable. And in some cases, these recommendations are not commensurate on the funding level or the capabilities of that state agency, but we think are science issues that are important for implementation that will bring more success to the Oregon Plan. After we get their responses back, we make responses, and these responses are sent to the governor's office and the legislatures for recording. And that's the way the process works for these long technical reports. And some of the technical reports that we finished are listed here. In the past, we have a report on forestry, which is called Recovery of Salmon in Western Oregon Forests. We have reports on predation by pinnipeds and seabirds in the ocean, several reports on hatchery practices, and a report also on harvest management that deals with fisheries in the ocean for coho salmon in particular. During the last year, you have a list of things here that we've done. A big report was the report on recovery of salmonids in Western Oregon lowlands. And this is a report that includes, you know, basically agriculture and lowlands in Western Oregon, focused pretty much on coho salmon. So those are some of the technical reports that we have done. And also listed in your report here are letter reports. A bunch of letter reports. Letter reports are usually solicited by state agencies to us. They want our input on certain issues that they're thinking about, planned implementation plans or policies. And those are listed there. There's letter reports, for example, to DSL on in-stream sand and gravel mining, evaluation of the monitoring plans and the monitoring workshop. We were active, actually, in sponsoring several workshops in the past. One of them this last year was on a workshop on with the Joint Salmon Recovery Task Force on measurable salmonid recovery criteria, defining what recovery really is and when do we get there, how do we know when we get there. We've also had workshops in the past on harvest management and supplementation in hatcheries. These workshop reports have been quite successful and quite popular. People come from out of state, for example, who attend these, so they're a very good scientific sounding board. Other letter reports, a lot of them actually solicited by ODF&W, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, or Native Fish Conservation Policy and Guidelines, Hatchery Management Policy and Guidelines, certainly by the monitoring team, an Oregon Plan Monitoring Strategy document, which we helped to review. Lower Columbia River COA Management Plan, as you can see, the Hinkle Creek Research Project, you'll be hearing more about later. Statewide riparian policy was something that we reviewed for the Governor's Natural Resources Office. And we also reviewed some proposals that are submitted by OWEB. And ongoing projects for this next year, our plate is quite full. We plan to have technical reports on a review of the water quality standards. It's a hot issue. Impact of urban and residential land uses on watershed function. This is our urban report. And the governor actually requested us to do a review of the biological opinions by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and National Marine Fisheries Service on issues concerning both the sucker and the coho salmon in the Klamath Basin. And this is something that we should have finished within a month or so. In addition, we're working on an Eastern Oregon Management Resources Management Report, and this will include issues in regards to forestry, ag, hydro development, as well as hatchery. So it'll include sort of all the land use practices in Eastern Oregon. And then we'll do an evaluation of the Oregon Plan Monitoring Program. I would like to say just a little bit about some of the findings of the IMST, sort of general findings. In practically all these major reports, one of the main issues that comes up is the need for a landscape or riverscape approach where we look at whole watersheds, not just portions of watersheds. And the reason for this is salmonids, as you know, occupy different habitats during different life history stages, all the way from headwaters through lowlands, estuaries, and the ocean. So that means that if you're going to have a recovery of salmon, in a lot of cases we have to integrate things over the whole life history cycle of the salmon. And one of the problems with doing this is that, of course, state agencies have various protocols, and they're, you know, either forestry or ag or things like that in different regions. So one of the big challenges of the Oregon Plan is to get cooperation and integration of monitoring and identification of some of these scientific issues that cross, you know, boundaries of both land use and state agencies. So, as I say, the landscape approach, as we call it, is certainly something that's very important and widely recognized now as looking at the big picture. Another thing that Kelly talked about, I think, was the need for long-term sustained monitoring. And along with this is the need for long-term sustained implementation of the Oregon Plan, because even though now we're seeing a boost in salmon production because of good ocean conditions, the next time we have a turnaround and have bad ocean conditions and poor productivity in the ocean, it's going to be imperative that we have better freshwater conditions to tide them over this low period of time. So it's really important to take the long-term perspective on this, both in monitoring and in regards to restoration efforts. So with that, I think I will close my remarks and see if there's any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. Members, do we have any questions?
Mr. Chair, just a comment. In spite of the poor planning and everything theoretically that we've had, and I dispute that, I would point out that the salmon did tide over through the bad time, and they're still here. So,
they squeaked by, let's say.
They squeak by, and I would submit this isn't the first time in history by.
No, that's right.
So,
But the more we can do to improve freshwater conditions, we can enhance that part of their life cycle, the better we're going to have a more quick response when ocean conditions do turn around. That's all.
Okay. I guess, Mr. Chair, my point is and has been for several sessions now, as long as our target is fish counts, we've got the wrong target. It's compliance with clean water that's the ultimate thing, and the salmon will, to a large degree, take care of themselves if we are doing the right thing for the watersheds, which basically is compliance with the Clean Water Act.
Interesting point, Representative. Doctor, a couple of questions for you. You had mentioned, I think in your comments, I made a note that you're currently engaged in coming up with a model that defines recovery?
This was something that was done in conjunction with a joint interim legislative committee. There was this committee that was formed, as you know, to look at recovery, and the IMST collaborated with that committee, as well as the National Marine Fisheries Service, held a workshop on this, and a report is going to be coming out on what recovery is, how it can be defined.
And do you have a time frame for that report, Doctor?
I think that depends upon the legislative committee. Bob Jacobson is the chair, was the chair of that, as you recall, and Stan Gregory has been working with him on that, and I think it's going to be fairly soon. I'm not exactly certain what the date is.
Thank you, Doctor. And members, just for your edification, our administrator just reminded me that we'll be hearing from that recovery task force on Tuesday. We'll be hearing from them. So, and then you also mentioned that you had compiled a predation report.
Yes.
Do you have, could you just summarize your conclusions of that? I'm sorry to ask you that. I'm sure.
One of the first reports that we did back in 1998, I think it was, and we looked at that time the evidence for predation by both pinnipeds, you know, seals and sea lions, as well as marine birds, which were largely Caspian terns at the time, and cormorants, and we actually got quite a bit of data from ODF&W and from National Marine Fisheries Service and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on this. And I guess what you could do to summarize this is you could say that predation by these animals can be either additive or compensatory. By additive, I mean if you take 10%, for example, the salmon that come down the Columbia River by turns, does that mean that 10% fewer adults are going to come back? That would be additive. So if you take 10% of the smolts, you're going to take 10% of the adults. Or compensatory, which would mean that if those 10% are killed by terns, then in the ocean, perhaps, you know, that number would not be, it would be compensated by less predation by their organisms. In other words, the healthy ones survive. And this has certainly been documented in a lot of the scientific literature. You have compensatory mortality. To make the long and the short of it, we found that there was no cogent evidence to support the fact that these things were having a marked effect on salmon recovery at that time. And this was sort of something in progress. Yes.
Now, are you continuing to study this then?
That report's finished. We aren't, but other people are. There are studies that are conducted by the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife on seals and sea lion predation.
Okay.
And there's a very extensive study that's studied on Caspian tern predation that's based out of Oregon State University, and some very good reports on this. And it certainly indicates that, for example, for the tern mortality studies, that steelhead smolts, which are larger, particularly hatchery steelhead smolts, are the ones that are hit by the Caspian terns the most intensely. And smaller fish and wild fish have less predation rates. But they're substantial as far as the numbers that are actually eaten by Caspian terns, for example. But there's no indication, for example, it's had an impact on the recovery of salmon in the Columbia River today. You heard about the numbers, so large numbers are coming back. So that didn't decimate the runs. During low run conditions, it could be more severe, but we just don't have the data to make quantitative assessments of the impact.
Okay. Representative Cruz.
I read a study a few years ago that basically tracked back to before the turn of the century, at a point in time when pinnipeds were virtually extinct on the Oregon coast, before we started protecting those critters, and I could see a direct correlation between the number of pinnipeds and the number of and adult survival and those coming back upstream. So you know, and we do have reports, you know, I'm not sure how scientific they are, but there's certainly anecdotal reports of massive pinniped takes in some of our inlets, and part of that I think is probably due to the fact that we've got jetties everywhere, so we've kind of narrowed the field, and they, you know, the gauntlet is small in a lot of places. So, you know, I guess I'm not quite understanding how, because our pinniped population is incredibly large now. And I've always thought that there was a direct competition between the Marine Mammal Protection Act and the salmon recovery process. And I guess I'm not understanding how you can't draw a relationship there.
Well, Representative Cruz, I will send you our predation report if you like. Actually, all these reports are available on the web, so you can get everything that I've mentioned on the web from the IMST. All I would say at this point is that pinnipeds and salmon have, you know, co-evolved together over thousands and thousands of years, and we've had certainly periods in the past we've had, you know, big pinniped populations and large salmonid populations, and that a lot of the evidence today indicates that the pinniped predation is sometimes exacerbated by hatchery releases. For example, a pulse of fish come down an estuary, and the pinnipeds are waiting for those fish to come down, and as opposed to more strung-out releases or migrations of wild fish. So there's some interactions between hatcheries, I think, and pinniped predation.
Mr. Chair, how far back in history do we have data that, for example, would show how far upstream pinnipeds have hunted? Have they always gone 100 miles upstream? Have they always done that? Do we know that for a fact? I see, and not being a scientist and not knowing quite how you do all these things, you know, I see that if the numbers get large, they have to expand the range, because only so many can hunt in a specific area, and we've got reports of them being way farther upstream than I remember them ever being, but I don't remember back into the 20s and 30s. I was very young then, so I mean, do we have that sort of data available, or is that sort of data set relatively new?
Well, I doubt if that kind of data goes back in a kind of reliable way very far. But the person who's an expert on this is Robin Brown with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and you might want to hear from him on specifics.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, and I think that we'll see. We have folks here from ODF&W today, correct? Okay. Could you come forward, Bruce? I'd like to ask you that question. Thank you, Doctor. Appreciate that. If you could state your name again and perhaps address Representative Cruz's question there.
Chair Krupp, members of the committee, Bruce McIntosh, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. On this question, again, as Bill mentioned, really need to get Robin Brown here to provide that information. That's not my area of expertise, and we'd be glad to get him here for you if the committee wants to arrange it.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize. I knew who we needed here, and I should have requested that person before I asked the question. So,
as Chair, I'd like to request that you could have Robin come forward perhaps on Tuesday and just share with us again briefly, help us answer this question. It is somewhat controversial, and I do find it ironic that the IMST report, at any rate, doesn't draw a definitive conclusion that predation is a major contributing factor. And I don't want to put words in Dr. Piercy's mouth here, but that has seemed to be the gist of what I understood that the report says. And I know that we've heard this before in other committees. I do find it ironic that we want to increase the survivability of smolts, because we think that that is, as we've heard today, testimony that is critical to the proper numbers, whatever that might be determined to be defined as recovery in the future when we have declines of ocean conditions, that we want the most smolts we can surviving in the wild due to management activities on the part of us, clean water compliance, so on and so forth. Is the department willing to bring forward new management techniques or increased management techniques to ensure that our efforts are coordinated? In other words, that through the Oregon plan, we're trying very hard to have healthier streams that produce more smolts. But yet, are we then taking the same the parallel track of saying, now that we've got those smolts migrating to the ocean, are we going to protect them through management techniques on the part part of your department to make sure that there aren't as many of those smolts being becoming lunch for some bird or animal on its way out to the ocean?
Representative Krupp, members of the committee, I think the department's perspective would be that we need to work with the federal entities on having the management options to deal with these variety issues. I've just started working on the Caspian Tern work group in the Lower Columbia, and that's basically our position in that situation to deal with, is that we need to deal with the human-caused situations there, but we also have to have the management tools to deal with these critters as, you know, they recover and become problems in places or not in other places. I think there are others that in the department can speak more directly to that, but those are the types of avenues we're pursuing in the federal arena on, you know, migratory birds and with the Marine Mammal Protection Act. So it's on our radar screen.
How successful do you believe that you will be in that endeavor?
I guess that's an open book at this point. We're keeping the pressure on that issue to maintain our management options. Not sure where that's going to go. The Tern stuff is under, in that instance, is under a court case at this point, and there is a process that we'll be going through with federal entities over the next 3 to 4 years with outcome we hope that will allow for Terns to continue, but at the same time we can manage them as they affect other things.
Well, I believe, if I recall correctly in my dim memory, that in the previous session I introduced legislation to have the state of Oregon petition the federal government for the ability to manage pinnipeds, and I think it was just restricted to pinnipeds for the purposes of salmon recovery. And I'm not going to ask you if that legislation would be helpful in your quest to perhaps get better cooperation from the federal government. But you might just make note of that and chat with Director Ball about that. I think that clearly we need to look at, as a state, making a very strong statement to the federal government that we think that since we are placing the burden upon landowners to comply with federal mandates, Clean Water Act, and the Oregon Plan, which is a good direction in my opinion, that we also need help from the federal government to give us some flexibility in managing the entire problem. And pinnipeds and birds are part of that problem. And so if we can be helpful with legislative direction, at least this chair would be certainly open to discussing it.
Chair Krupp, member of this committee, I will speak with Robin Brown about the possibility on Tuesday and work with Pete on the concept of maybe addressing this broader policy issue. The director's office can give some feedback on that too.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. The chair would like to call. Next, we're going to be discussing agency relationships with the Oregon Plan, and we'd like to have Stephanie Halleck from Oregon DEQ come forward. And anyone else that you have with you, Stephanie, and I see you have your trusty and faithful assistant. Welcome.
Thank you.
For the record, state your name.
For the record, I'm Stephanie Halleck, and I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, and with me is Mike Llewellyn, who's the administrator of the Water Quality Program at DEQ. And as you certainly know, we're a full partner and have been for some time in the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds. And our role is primarily protecting water quality for the surface water and the groundwater in the state of Oregon. And most of our activities on the Oregon plan relate to meeting the water quality needs of the fish and the aquatic species. Just briefly, for those of you who are not as familiar with DEQ as others may be, we are a decentralized agency, and so for the Oregon plan, in addition to the monitoring activities that you heard about earlier, and I always love it, by the way, when the science guys go first, because they do all the real work and provide us with the data that we need and certainly know what's going on the ground. In addition to what our folks in the lab do, we do have field staff in our regional office who work directly with the watershed councils, the soil and water conservation districts, with our federal partners, with our sister agencies on the Oregon plan. Of course, being an environmental agency responsible for protecting Oregon's water quality, one could say that our entire water quality program is focused on the Oregon plan for salmon and watersheds, but more specifically, of about 200 staff in the department in our water quality program, about at least until Tuesday, about 47 of those worked on the Oregon plan for salmon and watersheds, and that number has now been reduced by 11. But we still have a fair amount of folks working on all aspects of the program. And what we do, just to give a framework, we play several roles. First of all, we establish water quality standards. So when you hear the acronym TMDL, what that stands for is total maximum daily load of pollution that a particular stream or segment of stream can assimilate. And that depends on how much water is in there, how many sources are contributing to it. And what a TMDL does is establish it through a rigorous analysis, modeling, and lots of other tools, exactly how much of a particular type of pollution that water body can handle. And what I have for you today, and I'll let Mike hand these out, and I'm not going to go into it in detail, but it is a map of all of the subbasins in Oregon, the water subbasins, and it shows, it refers to a list, which you sometimes hear referred to as the 303D list. That refers to Section 303D of the Federal Clean Water Act that requires all streams that do not meet water quality standards to be listed and some kind of a plan to be developed so that those streams will come into compliance. On the right-hand side of that map, you'll see the schedule. We are under an agreement with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and a consent agreement in the court for some of these streams to complete these load allocations by a time certain, and I'm pleased to report that we're on schedule to do so. So that's one of the most important roles we play in the Oregon plan, is to set these loads. Now, once the loads have been set, there are a variety of tools that we have in the department to help people meet them. Obviously, we issue permits to what we refer to as point source dischargers, and those would be industries that have discharges into streams and rivers, or they could be municipal sewage treatment plants that have discharges into streams or rivers. And we issue permits, and in those permits, there will be what are called load allocations that they must meet that have been set during the TMDL process. We also have technical assistance to be provided to some of the smaller municipalities and some of the industries, advice on particular technologies they might use, what they need to comply with the regulations, that sort of thing. We do have a couple of key financial assistance programs. One is referred to as the State Revolving Loan Fund. That is a federal program. It used to be a federal grant program. In the old days, it was called the Construction Grants Program. It is to provide money to municipal to upgrade and build, when necessary, municipal treatment plants. And we provide a match for that, and that is a bond-funded activity. The second source of funding under the Oregon plan that we contribute is referred to as 319 money. This refers to Section 319 of the Clean Water Act again, and this is grant money to help so-called non-point sources. Those are other sources of pollution than the factories or municipal sewage treatment plants. These are grant monies that they can use for projects on the ground to help minimize pollution, and we work a lot in partnership with the folks in agriculture and forestry and some of the urban to solve, and also in the urban areas to solve some of the urban stormwater problems. So that's what those grant funds are used for. We also do monitoring, and you've heard all about that, so I'm not going to go into that in great detail. The main thing that I just wanted to touch on a bit more is the TMDL program, and I'm sure that if there are any questions today, it will be about that. We, as the, you can see from the map, we have a relatively aggressive schedule that has been worked out with the federal government. And one thing I should mention is our role in all of this is pretty much dictated because we are delegated authority in the state of Oregon by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to administer these programs, to administer the requirements of the Clean Water Act in Oregon. So if, and delegation is a process, a formal process that we go through. EPA doesn't just magically one day say, okay, you get to do this now. We have to have the statutory authority from the legislature. We have to be able to be sure we have enough staff to do the program. There's all kinds of requirements for match, et cetera. But we've been delegated for some time to administer these requirements on behalf of the federal government. But if we did not do it, then the U.S. EPA has a requirement under the Clean Water Act to administer the requirements in Oregon. What a total maximum daily load consists of, it is a process by which we, with a local advisory committee, we have some examples of where we have completed these are for the Tualatin in the metropolitan Portland area. It was one of the first. For the Grand Ronde up in northeast Oregon, for the Umatilla up in northeast Oregon, for portions of the Rogue in southwest, you can see on the map. It's a rigorous process where we do work with the local folks and establish the load allocations. And what is actually included in a TMDL are the specific numeric load allocations plus what are called water quality management plans. And in those water quality management plans, there is a component that the agricultural community contributes through the requirements of Senate Bill 1010, and I'm sure that the Department of Ag will be talking to you about that today, and also the forest contribution under the Forest Practices Act. And that all goes up to, as a package, to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. And then in approving or disapproving those, they must consult with the services, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and NOAA Fisheries, formerly known as the National Marine Fisheries Service. And so far, we are very pleased to tell you that all of the TMDLs that we have developed collaboratively with our services and submitted to EPA have been approved. And that has been more necessary in consultation with the services. So I think Oregon's program has been working well. I think the last thing that I would like to touch on the TMDL program before taking your questions, and I also have a handout for you, is some of you may have heard recently about a court decision in Baker County referred to as the Hawes decision. And this has to do with the load allocations that are set on streams in Oregon where there are no point sources. There are only non-point sources of pollution. There was a decision in Baker County that the judge ruled there that they did not believe that DEQ had the authority to do those, set those total maximum daily loads for non-point streams, and did not have an authority to enter in with into a memorandum of agreement with the U.S. EPA to do that work. What this letter that I just passed out is the advice to us from the Department of Justice. The state is appealing that ruling, and we're in the process of that. And as you will see in the letter, it gives us guidance in the third paragraph that we may, the Department of Agriculture and DEQ may continue to work on TMDLs and 10 plans on our existing schedules, but we cannot take final action to adopt TMDLs or 1010 plans that include streams or stream segments that, and the term water quality limited means do not meet water quality standards solely because of non-point sources. And there's also one sentence on the reverse side of the page that makes clear that the Department of Justice advises that the Haas case does not affect previously approved TMDLs or 1010 plans. So our work is ongoing while this court case unfolds, and I should mention to you that one of the reasons an appeal was made is that there was a court decision in California referred to as Poncelino, and we can provide more information to you on that if you want it, that was not consistent with this ruling in Baker County. So that was one reason there was an appeal, and the other reason is quite honestly that we don't agree with the finding in Baker County. The state does not agree with it, which is another reason that we are appealing. So that is all I'm going to speak about today, and Mike or I would be happy to answer any questions that you might have about the Oregon plan or any other water quality activities at DEQ.
Well, you've opened up a Pandora's box because we have some questions for you, Representative Tomei and Representative Dingfelder.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm so unfamiliar with some of these issues, so if you could clarify them for me, I would really appreciate it. So I'm not sure what the Haas decision, what the outcome of this is, what that means.
Representative Tomei, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to try and do that, although I'm not a lawyer. But the outcome, if the final court decision upholds that the state cannot enter into agreement to do this work on behalf of EPA, and the work that they're referring to is establishing pollutant loads on streams that for which the pollution is contributed primarily by, it would be by agricultural or forest sources, and most of that is in rural Oregon, as you can well imagine. If the court finds that we're not allowed to do that work anymore, then we won't do that work anymore. And if the court finds that we are allowed to do that work, then we would continue to set those loads, and actions would need to be taken on the land to meet the water quality standards on those streams. May I say one more thing? If Oregon cannot do the work, then a whole separate issue would be whether there would be a legal challenge to whether or not the U.S. EPA could do the work. Because if the court found that our agreement with EPA was not valid to do the work, EPA would still be a federal EPA would be under obligation at the Clean Water Act to then set the loads themselves, and that may or may not be subject to another court challenge. I hope I didn't confuse the issue.
Just a little bit, if I may try to clarify.
Next.
Well, on similar, same okay. issue, unless you have something on okay. same issue.
No, we're going to take one at a time. Representative Tomei.
I'm still trying to understand this. So the court decision said that you did not have the authority to establish what the load could be or should be in that stream. Is that correct?
Yes, and the mechanism by which we do that is through the memorandum of agreement with EPA that gives us the authority to do that. So they challenge the authority of that as well.
Follow up, please. Challenge your authority or EPA's authority, or both?
The state's authority, not EPA's. That's my understanding. But if we go too far into this, I will want to ask if you would invite someone from Department of Justice here, because I don't want to misspeak on any of the legal issues.
Thank you so much.
Okay, Representative Dingfeld.
Thank you. Stephanie, I have a couple of questions in regards to the TMDL process. I just want to clarify, because I remember last session I got asked a lot of questions since I worked on the first TMDL in Tualatin, which was a really interesting process. And I just want to clarify, or have you clarify for the committee, that when the TMDLs are set and approved, then basically we're moving into the implementation phase, and that doesn't necessarily mean that that basin is meeting all water quality standards. And is that correct?
That's correct, Representative Pinkett.
Okay. And I think there is some confusion, because when people hear that the TMDLs have been completed, I think there is a perception that that means all work has been done, and in essence, it's work is just beginning, that the goals have been set. And I think that when you communicate, especially in this building, it's a very complicated process. I mean, having worked in this field for almost 20 years, I'm still not completely sure I understand the intricacies of the TMDL process. But having sort of lived through it and having to explain it to people in Washington County, since the Tualatin was one of the first listed basins, that when the TMDLs are set, it sort of starts the process of then doing these plans and programs to meet the goals in the TMDL.
That's correct, Representative Dingfelder. Absolutely correct. And of the 47, I think I mentioned now, down to 36 staff in the Oregon plan who do this work, I think approximately six or seven of those are actually focused on TMDL implementation, working in the basins where the TMDLs, again, are just the load allocations and the plan for achieving water quality standards. The goal, of course, is to ultimately achieve those water quality standards, so there must be actions taken either in the permits or on the land to ensure that we do that. And your point is very well taken in that regard.
Can I follow up?
Yes.
So do we have any basins in Oregon where we've actually achieved those goals and we can sort of check them off and say, okay, we're meeting those goals currently? Or is it based on different parameters?
Representative Dingfelder, Mr. Chairman, the TMDL that has been in place the longest is in the Tualatin, and none of them have been in place long enough. There have been some incremental goals achieved, but there haven't been in place long enough to totally remove the entire stream from what is referred to as a 303D list. There are some segments that get removed as they achieve water quality standards, but it is very much an incremental process. Mike could probably tell you in more detail some of the stream segments that have been removed. We do revisit each of the TMDLs every 5 years to make sure that we made the right decisions in the first place, to see how the conditions might have changed, to see what other kind of actions might be taken. We have been through that five-year review process with the Tualatin and did, in fact, make some changes. I don't think that any of the others yet have come up on their five-year review process.
Okay. Thank you, Stephanie.
Representative Cruz.
So many directions to go, and I almost got diverted there to 303, but I think I'll stay with where I was headed. And that, because 303 could take us all day.
And we don't have that, Representative. We've got a half hour left, so.
Get back to lawsuit for just a minute. If Judge Baxter is upheld, that would put into question basically everything non-point that you have done. Was his ruling so specific as to exclude any stream that had point source in it from consideration? And the real point I want to get at here is there's been a legal argument for some point in time as to whether Clean Water gives EPA the authority at all to go into non-point. So is there any way, does this lawsuit end theoretically at the Oregon Supreme Court, or could this potentially go into federal court?
Representative Cruz and Mr. Chair, the first thing that I would offer is that I understand we have a follow-up session with you specifically on TMDLs and 303D list, if I'm not mistaken, okay. And it might be better for your time to take all of this on at that point, and we can talk to counsel and probably have someone better than I here to answer some of your questions.
That would be absolutely fine. But I'm wondering if there's some long-term ramifications here. I know this has been, Chuck's shaking his head back there, but I'm not sure that this doesn't encourage some folks to go there, because I know it's been debated in this building for a long time whether the authority actually exists in federal law for some of the things that EPA is doing. So it'd be nice to kind of get a sense of that universe at the next presentation. So.
I think you're correct, Representative Cruz, and as I alluded to earlier, the Pronsolino case would be another example of where there was a differing result.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. Where the Hawes ATOL, I don't know if it was a family or group, or were they, I just want to really get down to the nuts and bolts of this, were they concerned about the amounts that were going to be established in these creeks as far as agricultural runoff and silt from ag and forestry? I would assume that's where we're trying to get. Were they more concerned about the amounts that were going to be applied to these streams of ag runoff and silt due to logging? Was that their main concern in this issue, or was it they just did not believe that you at DEQ and these other folks had the right to enter into this agreement with EPA? Or is it both, or is it neither? What's the crux of this problem? That's what I want to know.
Representative Schaffler, chairs, I would not presume to speak for the Haws, but my supposition would be that it would be both.
And maybe Representative, we'll get that fleshed out when we get into,
right,
into those in more detail. I mean, it's not a simple issue. So, go ahead. Do you have anything else?
That's it.
Any other questions from the committee? I love the gavels.
Wield it carefully, Representative.
I always have.
Yes, you have indeed. Any further questions? I do.
No.
You know, some of us believe that TMDLs stand for too many darn laws. I think the Haws decision has certainly some impact on what may occur ultimately here. I would ask you a couple of things. 319 functions, do they actually regulate non-point source?
Mr. Chair, no. That is an incentive program, if you will.
Okay, so it's an incentive. So how do you distribute those monies then? What criteria do you utilize for that?
I'm going to let Mike help me out here, but I will start by saying there is a rigorous process. There are grant applications and review and a lot of local input. And maybe Mike could add any detail that is pertinent.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Mike Llewellyn, Administrator of the Water Quality Division. Essentially, it's an annual process that actually starts with EPA. It's EPA pass-through money to the state that we administer. EPA establishes annual objectives in terms of where they would like to see the money go. It's usually at kind of a macro level, quite frankly. But we do go through a process of putting out requests for proposals. We try to enunciate in our criteria the type of projects that we would like to see happen. We work, frankly, at a local level, touching base with OWEB, because a lot of these projects actually leverage not only OWEB money, but other federal grant programs as well, so that people who apply can get as many dollars towards their project as possible. Our RFPs enunciate the criteria by which we'll judge the projects, so it's very clear what people are competing for. And some of our field staff actually work with project proponents, particularly if somebody didn't get a project in the last year, and they want to know, what can I do to make the project proposal next year better in terms of quality? We work with them on that front as well.
Okay.
And
very
Mr.
Good.
Chair,
yes?
I would just add one thing, that in 2002 we gave out approximately $1.8 million in these grants and expect to have a similar amount in 2003.
So then that leads to the next question. Have you given out all of the money that's been allocated to you by the EPA for this process?
Yes, Mr. Chair, we have.
Okay.
Yes.
Fair enough.
So it is a capped fund, or you can get a designated amount of 319.
That's correct.
He just speaks right out.
Representative.
No sense of what's appropriate.
Please.
Excuse me, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
You. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr.
You're
Chair.
You're being...
Well, I had to gavel for a minute. I got carried.
Mike, could you please give us an example of a project that had been funded?
Mr. Chair and Representative Tomei, there's several types of projects that we work on. The most common is projects where a landowner is trying to do some type of riparian work under the Oregon plan, let's say reestablishment of vegetation, fencing, other projects establishing large woody debris. That's a typical rural project. We have projects where we provide money to groups that do education information campaigns so that people are aware of what is non-point source pollution. We provide money to, as the previous speakers talked about, where watershed councils are doing water quality monitoring so they have better data in their local area. We provide money so that they can actually have the funds to hire staff or do contract work to collect local supplemental data in streams for a large range of water quality parameters. All sorts of projects along those lines.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. One last thing. Could you provide us with the list of your 2002-319 RFPs that were granted, and the ones, and provide us a list with, if you could, what you've received so far for 2003. And with that, I thank you both very much, and we need to move along. We have 25 minutes and two agencies yet. Ted, why don't you come forward, Oregon Department of Forestry, and whoever else you have with you. Welcome to you both, and is it Joe? Very, very pleased to meet your acquaintance. Thanks for coming, and be sure that you state your name for the record.
Okay. Chair Krupp and members of the Water Committee, my name is Ted Lawrenson. I'm Assistant State Forester with the Oregon Department of Forestry. I have with me today Joe Emmerich, who is our Oregon Plan Coordinator. I'm going to go through some slides pretty quickly here. Do want to make the first point with the Oregon Plan and the strong roots notion. Both in the context of Oregon's forests and the Department of Forestry, prior to there being an Oregon plan, forest landowners recognized that there were issues with fish, and they were taking efforts, working in collaboration with the Department of Forestry and Fish and Wildlife, to actually do in-stream assessment, riparian assessment, and certainly to address forest practices issues. So, to some degree, the forests sector were providing a model or leadership with regard to the Oregon plan before there was an Oregon plan. Second point in terms of the strong roots is I think it's fair to say, in my opinion at least, based upon fairly good data, that the best water quality and the best habitat and generally the best fish populations are on forest lands, which really sets a striking irony because to a large degree it's been the forest lands where a lot of the debate's been focused about wanting to do more, at least in terms of the federal perspective. Part of the logic there is that, gee whiz, we need to protect the populations that are good, so let's do more on forest lands. But there are certain disincentives that come out of that logic, which we might want to talk about later. Okay. Department of Forestry, as DEQ mentioned, it's fair to say that most of what we do really relates to the Oregon plan. We've got some basic core businesses, forestry assistance, forest practices, protection from fire, forest resource planning, and state forest. We'll talk about the roles that come out of each one of those programs to some degree. But it is fair to say that all those programs have a certain role with regard to the Oregon plan. In terms of the process in developing our efforts under the Oregon Plan, we did something a little bit different than most other agencies did. We reached agreement with the landowner community basically on the key factors for decline that they felt that they could address and that were legitimate issues. We then applied a strategic approach to developing and implementing a voluntary effort to address those factors. And as you probably heard in terms of the OWEB presentation, the bulk of the Oregon plan efforts in terms of restoration projects have been done on forest lands and to a large degree with landowner funds as opposed to OWEB funds. And I think that we also, in that context, once we got agreement on both the key factors of decline and the strategies to use, we then built that effort into our strategic plans and also then took the effort to train the landowner community how to implement those plans. And I think that's been a pretty important effort. The Department of Forestry views the Oregon Plan as something that is part of our overall charge. So you heard Jim Brown talk about, in terms of the governor's view, it kind of well defines the Department of Forestry's view, as you might well expect. But we do view the Oregon Plan as having social, economic, and environmental components. And through our programs, we really got to address all three of those to maintain a sustainable program. And so that's part of our effort to do that. one of the areas where we provide critical leadership and a critical role is in policy leadership, particularly on federal issues. I want to give you some sense of the importance of that issue, at least in the context of the magnitude of how it can impact the Oregon program. You've, I think, heard some issues relative to the forest health issues. But in terms of the regulatory program, we were out on a field trip with National Marine Fisheries Service Regional Director Bob Lawn, the Deputy Regional Director of the Forest Service, is acting in that position now, some Fish and Wildlife Service folks, looking at Oregon Plan projects and forest land. And one of the particular projects we looked at was a culvert replacement on Weyerhaeuser lands, and it was done to improve fish passage. And the Forest Service Deputy Regional Director asked, well, how much did it cost to do this project? And Weyerhaeuser said, well, it's $13,000. And he goes, well, that's really interesting, because on federal lands, it would cost us about $170,000 in process to begin that project. And then he turned around and said, okay, on state forest land, how much would it cost you to do this project? And I said, $13,000. Assuming we can't maintain an appropriate regulatory scheme, that magnitude of impact would basically have some major problems in terms of implementing the Oregon plan. So we've taken a pretty aggressive effort to address federal regulatory issues and try and make sure that the pathway for forest landowners in terms of doing these projects is something that's still doable and practical to them. As I talk about, we also look at our role as trying to describe and achieve sustainable forestry in the context of social, economic, and environmental outputs for the forests. And we do that through a forest assessment process, looking at conditions and trends, as was described earlier. The monitoring process, we look at forestry issues in that context. And from that assessment, then, the Board of Forestry tries to define their policy objectives to their forestry program for Oregon, which is their policy document. We think that's pretty important to try and...
Yes, Representative Tomei.
Could you say just a little bit about the assessment process? To whom are you assessing?
Representative Tomei and Chair Krupp, what we do on about a seven-year basis is go and look at fundamental conditions on forest lands in terms of social conditions, economic conditions, and environmental conditions. So, for example, we look at growth versus harvest. We look at fire conditions, forest health conditions, insect and disease trends. We look at the economic outputs from the forest lands, jobs, that sort of thing. We compile that and use those data and trends then to build a policy document that the Board of Forestry calls the Forestry Program for Oregon.
Okay, I'm clear. You're making an assessment, not assessing property owners.
No, that's correct. We're making an assessment, yes, in terms of gathering data for making policy. Excuse me.
Thank you for that clarification. Very good. Please continue, Ted.
The other key role in the policy arena is adaptive management, and I've apparently been asked to include the Hinkle Creek thing in this particular section here, and I'll ask Joe to pass this out. Clearly, with forestry, as any science and land management practice, you've got a state of knowledge that changes over time and space, and adaptive management is the approach, clearly, in using that change in knowledge to improve your management practices. We take that role very seriously because forestry is a very long-term agenda, and people have to have some sense of understanding of what the expectations are and where things are changing. One of the key issues we've dealt in terms of the policy arena, particularly from the federal perspective, is the notion of cumulative effects. I think Dr. Piercy describes maybe better in terms of watershed scale effects, but one of the things we've done to address this, and it's really a research issue, is to look at what are the watershed scale effects of contemporary forest practices. And the Hinkle Creek Project is an example of this effort, and it's a very unique effort. It's very clear that most of the data we have on forest practices really reflect what practices were done 20 years ago in terms of watershed scale effects, right, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. And this approach will actually be a paired watershed study on managed forest lands in Douglas County, looking at what are the physical processes affected by forest practices on lands that are managed for forestry, and how do those physical processes affect the biological outputs. And this is a really critical research project. It really allows us to get ahead of the policy debate that's going to occur and is occurring in terms of watershed scale effects. What makes this particular effort unique and represents a good collaboration that's going on, this is a 10-year project at a minimum, and we have to have a forest lander willing to basically say, I'm not going to harvest in the watershed that's going to be the reference site for at least 5 years. So it's a huge commitment for a landowner to say, I'm not going to harvest in a 2,500-acre watershed for 5 years. Roseburg Forest Products has made that commitment. We've partnered with all sorts of folks. We've got an OWEB grant to put in the infrastructure to do the monitoring and assessment work. And by infrastructure, I mean all the monitoring devices, the weirs, the physical hard stuff. You got to look at water flow, water temperatures, the physical chemical properties of the water. They've paid for that infrastructure. We're leveraging Douglas County funds, federal funds. And by doing this, we're also getting other folks then coming on board in terms of doing some of the biologic stuff. So it's a really good model. To make it be fully successful in the context of getting the kind of research data we need to have replicants of it in terms of doing it in other regions of the state. But this is going to be the test bed for starting that process. Something like this is very, very expensive. Right now, we've leveraged the funds. We're going to try and get federal funds. But it does get to the active management process, and it's certainly an effort to try and get out ahead of the fundamental conflict about people's fears about the watershed scale effects that we really don't have answers to. Okay, and with that, I'm going to pass the baton to Joe to talk about some specifics in terms of our roles.
Welcome.
Representative.
For the record.
Krupp and members of the committee. I'm Joe Emmerich with the Oregon Department of Forestry, and I serve the department as a policy analyst and also coordinate the department's Oregon Plan activities. Over the past year, the Board of Forestry, the department, and various stakeholders have been discussing what sustainable forestry means and what Oregonians want out of their forests. And all of these discussions are being folded into revising the board's strategic plan, which we call the Forestry Plan for Oregon. It is in a draft state at this point in time, but I'd like to bring forward a key board strategy that's included in that proposed plan, and that is to protect, maintain, and restore the soil and water resources of Oregon's forests. And key to that is supporting and contributing our efforts in the Oregon Plan while sustaining a healthy economy. There are a number of actions that the board plans to take that will further achieving this strategy. One is that the board will continue to use the Forest Practices Act as a means to protect soil productivity and water quality, and also to promote the ongoing voluntary resource restoration and enhancement efforts by forest landowners throughout the state for the Oregon Plan, which you heard about in the biennial report on Tuesday. As Bill Piercy mentioned, the IMST would like for agencies to start looking at our actions and how they affect across the landscape. So the board will promote understanding, acceptance, and support across all land uses for relevant indicators of water quality conditions based on beneficial uses and the use of these indicators to develop stream protection policies that result in consistent application of state water quality standards across land uses. Another action that the board plans to take is to ensure that forest landowners comply with state non-point source water quality standards as their contribution to providing Oregonians with high-quality drinking water. The board will also promote renewed long-term watershed research like the Hinkle Creek study to study the effectiveness of the most current forestry best management practices in providing protection for soil and water resources, and also research and monitoring related to roads. Another part of that strategy is that the board will promote the maintenance of forest lands as forest lands, and also promoting the establishment of new forests as key elements in promoting high water quality and protection of soil productivity. There are many other indicators besides soil and water that play into sustainable forestry. Productive capacity is one of those. And a tension exists between the various indicators of what a sustainable forest is. And for example, if we lose private forest land to development, we lose the benefits to water quality that those forests provide. Therefore, we need continued economic incentives for private investments in forest lands. And the discussion goes on from there amongst all of the interdependent indicators of a sustainable forest. ODF plays a variety of roles in the Oregon Plan. We have participated at the grassroots level with work directly with landowners and watershed councils and others to implement voluntary measures and monitoring. We also administer the Forest Practices Act and provide technology transfer, and we administer a variety of cost share programs. As a landowner, State Forest Program provides management on state-owned lands to achieve the greatest permanent value, and they define that as providing a full range of social, economic, and ecological benefits while achieving a balance between short-term and long-term economic returns. They also collaborate with other landowners, complete restoration projects, and comply with state and federal laws. As an agency, we collaborate with other state agencies that you've heard from on Tuesday and today to monitor and to conduct outreach and talk about policy issues and also to participate on projects with one another. As an agency, we coordinate with the federal agencies on road use where roads cross both state and federal lands. Issues can arise that we coordinate with them on. Also with forest fire policy and forest health issues, and to allay unintended consequences as a result of federal and state policies. We also provide landowner assistance through technology transfer, management planning advice. We conduct inspections and offer guidance. And we also conduct enforcement and monitoring and provide a number of incentives. The Forest Practices Act, passed in 1971, sought to set standards for commercial activity involving the establishment, management, or harvesting of trees in Oregon's forest lands, and this is conducted on the non-federal forests. The basic purposes of the Forest Practices Act are, one, because forests matter. Forests provide clean water, but they also provide products, tax revenues, and result in healthy communities. Oregonians also value their forests, and forest landowners and operators are taking the responsibility to be good stewards for those lands. In the recent State of the Environment report, a conclusion is made that water quality on forest lands has improved with increased regulation of forest practices, and water quality on forest land remains good and is generally better than found on other land uses. The Forest Practices Advisory Committee in August of 2000 made recommendations to the Board of Forestry for a number of changes or improvements to the Forest Practices Act. And their recommendations included issues related to roads, fish passage, landslides, and riparian protection. This past summer, we completed rules as a result of that and the board's discussions related to roads, public safety, and landslides. And over the next year, the board will be considering recommendations of both the Forest Practices Advisory Committee and another East Side group that that was formed to look specifically at east side conditions relating to riparian function and the riparian rule. So that discussion will occur over the next year. There is an incentive directly in the rules for forest practices where landowners can propose additional harvest in exchange for stream improvement work. And in that case, they might put logs or trees into the stream, or they might provide fencing or grazing management practices. Self-proposed alternative plans are acceptable if approved by the department, and these are key principles in the voluntary elements of the Oregon Plan. We need to look for ways to facilitate the voluntary work that these landowners are doing. And you heard from Jay Nicholas on Tuesday how much of a part of the Oregon Plan forest landowners have contributed. And if I might answer Representative Schaffler's question about thanking these folks, there is an effort underway between the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and the Department of Forestry to honor these landowners. I believe that Jim Brown will be talking with the leaders of the Senate and the House soon, if he can fit that in to his busy schedule. Where we might host a celebration here at the Capitol to honor these folks at this point in the Oregon Plan and to tell them thank you for what they've done. And with that, I conclude my comments.
Very good. Before we have any questions, members, Chuck, we're running a bit late here. Is it too much to ask that you could give us your presentation on Tuesday?
Oh, I'd be glad to.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate your flexibility. Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Emmerich, a few slides back, you indicated ODF rule as an agency coordinates with the federal agencies in regard to road use, fire policy, forest health, and unintended consequences. Do you have any recent examples of those unintended consequences?
I have a great example. Just last week, I was talking with an ODFW biologist who works in the field directly with our Tillamook area foresters, and he said that it's really sad to be out on these operations where harvesting is occurring. The landowner's willing to put trees or logs in the stream and has a cable across the stream where they could lower logs down and into the stream in streams where these functions are needed for fish, but these actions are not occurring now because of a federal permitting process by the Army Corps of Engineers. So we're working at different levels to try to resolve that issue. I think Jim Brown mentioned on Tuesday that he's speaking with Bob Lawn about ideas that we have on resolving those issues. Broad acceptance of the Oregon Plan for salmon and watersheds would be a tremendous help in resolving some of these issues. And we're also working at the field level, at the staff level, to try to go out to the stream and look at things and try to sort things out.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. On that, so we're just waiting for the federal government to finish their paperwork before you can do this. And if that's the case, isn't there any way we could assume that so that we could allow these landowners to do this work without waiting for some bureaucracy to hold them up? And they're willing to do it. That's a good thing, the way I understand it. So
there are some particulars in the Army Corps of Engineers Regional General Permit that landowners find onerous. For example, when they're out on the ground in the past, they only needed the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife's approval to put wood in the stream. But now they need the permit from, or approval rather, from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as well. That makes a delay, and once the operation's gone, there's no longer an economic avenue to easily place those logs in the stream.
Chair Krupp and Representative Schaffler, it's a philosophical debate. I mean, as Joe talked about, our rules allow landowners to remove a few more trees in the riparian area, replacing logs in the creek. From federal perspective, that's terrible. It should not allow them to diminish any riparian function at all. And by doing so, they specifically exempt that from the expedited permit process they have. So they have basically a different philosophy than we do, and it results in these conflicts in terms of people not being able to do the work.
So it's not just a bureaucratic holdup. It's disagreement on how to go about doing it. Okay, thank you.
If I may, another classic example where we have the same philosophical rub is on-road use. Landowners to use roads across federal land, to some degree, the federal agency then has to go through consultation with the federal services, and and they feel that through that process that they can then burden the private landowner's action as a condition of that road use permit. And so if the landowner has an alternative to get the federal road use permit, like building more road, sometimes they're compelled to do it for a whole host of reasons rather than do the most environmentally sensitive thing using the existing roads. There's been you can go on and on with unintended consequences. There are a bunch of them in terms of the process that are mainly federal related.
Okay, one quick question for you, and then I think we're going to be finished if there are no further questions from the members. In your strategic plan, are you intending to change anything in regard to your practices, which have proven to be very successful in terms of thinning and fire loading, or removing the fire load, rather? Are you going to change that?
Chair Krupp and members of the committee, the policy gets more specific about being aggressive in terms of promoting federal actions that would address that particular issue in terms of active management. It also addresses emphasizing the need to have an effective fire protection program as well on federal land. So it addresses it from both ways in the sense of fire management, fire protection, as well as fuels management. And fuels production and harvest and active management as appropriate.
Okay. Yes, Representative.
Have you received anything at all relative to the President's Forest Initiative, where he's going? I mean, have conversations already started, and so you can kind of get an idea of what impacts are going to be?
Chair Krupp and Representative Cruz, members of the committee, we work actually very closely with Region 6 of the Forest Service, and Linda Goodman, the new regional forester, has been very good to work with. She understands and appreciates both the need to consider the state's interests and their conduct, particularly in fire suppression issues, as well as to address the need to address the fuels conditions on federal lands. We're also working at the federal level with the Fire and Aviation Management staff, and we've also been working fairly closely with Congressman Walden's office and other parties to also maintain an avenue of communication that way. We're relatively optimistic on the fire management issue that a number of the issues that we found this past fire season that were federal issues will be effectively addressed. And we're looking at other options if that's not the case.
I guess, Mr. Chair, it would just be the President's talked about kind of local management to a degree, and if somehow through the process, U.S. Forest Service is willing to delegate authority to the State Department of Forestry, we might be able to do some more positive things here. So I'm very interested in how those negotiations go.
Now, please keep us informed on that as we go through the session, especially in the other committee that I chair, Agriculture and Forestry. I will be introducing shortly a resolution to Congress in regards to another potential devastating fire season, depending on our snowpack. The 900,000 acres of federal lands that were burnt last year, and how that the Bush administration has moved forward through the Department of Forestry, or U.S. Forestry, that a number of active management type tools. And we think that it's appropriate that we urge Congress to adopt those, and we urge the administration to get those adopted through the process. It is an absurdity that we cannot manage our forests on the federal level as well as your department has done so at the state level, and that we continue to burn up the taxpayers' resources. We allow the incredibly devastating fires that devastate beautiful natural resources of wood, timber, wildlife, and it's all preventable, at least to a degree.
Chair Crump, members of the committee, in your other capacity, we certainly offer both this committee and your other committee the opportunity to hear a presentation we put together about a half hour long on the fire season and the consequences and lessons learned from that. If you'd like that, we'd be happy to do that.
I would, and would you please contact Ray Kelly about that?
And
I think it's appropriate.
On the other issue, we have been working with the Federal Forest Service, particularly in the Blue Mountains, to assess what level of timber harvests may be available given current stocking condition of federal lands and certain limitations in terms of diameter and that sort of thing. And when those data are available, we certainly have to share those with you as well.
Thank you very much. Well, we appreciate your help today. Members, before we adjourn, just to let you know that there are other agencies that do have interaction with the Oregon plan. Here's a letter that was just passed out to you from Oregon Parks Department that just shares with you a little bit about their cooperation in their part of this, too. So with that, we're going to be adjourned. First thing on Tuesday morning, we will hear from Oregon Department of Agriculture. Again, thank you for being flexible. And Pete?
Real quick, for your information, there'll be a session from the Senate House Transportation and Economic Development Committee next Wednesday. I'll get you time and specifics to discuss the issues related to water rights and water on the Columbia River. It's an interstate issue. And I'll get information to you on that. Our committee is invited to come and watch and participate possibly if we know ahead of time.
Very, very good. Thank you, members. We appreciate it very much. We're adjourned.
Wednesday next week.